for August Planning Accessible Temporary Events. My name is Peter Berg. I am the moderator for today's session. I am with the Great Lakes ADA Center. The ADA Audio Conference Series is a project of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is the leader in providing information on the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA Network is comprised of 10 regional centers. You can reach your ADA center by calling 800-949-4232. The ADA National Network is funded by the National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research, which is under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We are pleased to be joined by two members of the ADA National Network for today's session. They've got a whole host of great information for you. For those of you that were not able to access the handouts prior to the session, please be advised that those materials will be available when the archive is posted of today's session. So within 24 hours, the audio archive will be available on ada-audio.org along with the materials, and we will have an edited transcript of today's session available within 7 business days. And there will be one additional document that wasn't currently available that we will post with the materials. And that document is Planning an Accessible Meeting for People with Environmental Sensitivities or Intolerances. With that, I would like to introduce today's speakers. From the Northeast ADA Center, Jennifer Peary, Access Specialist, will be our first presenter today. And we're also joined by Rob Gilkerson. He is with the Rocky Mountain ADA Center, and he is an Architectural Information Specialist. They will be going back and forth throughout the presentation, and at the end we will have time for questions and answers. So with that, I want to welcome both Jennifer and Rob and turn it over to Jennifer.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Peter. We're looking forward to today's program, and we do have a lot of information to share with you. So I'm just going to start by going over our agenda briefly with everyone. We have decided to focus on several key areas related to planning accessible temporary events. We're going to begin with a review of disability awareness and non-discrimination requirements that are found in the Americans with Disabilities Act. And then we'll move on to talking about the planning process, getting set and ready for a temporary event and what to think about in terms of access. And then we'll kind of narrow that down a little bit more and talk about physical accessibility and getting to the event site. And then we'll talk about participating in the event and auxiliary aids and services and other things that should be taken into consideration. And then we'll move on to service and support facilities and wrap it all up with some helpful resources if you will be planning a temporary event. Moving on to slide 12. Normally we reserve a slide like this for the end of the presentation, but in order to, you know, right off the bat mention to everyone that you please don't feel obligated to take a ton of notes during today's webinar, because the content for this program was developed using the planning guide for making temporary events accessible to people with disabilities. And you can access the full guide at adata.org from the National ADA Network. You can also contact your local ADA center if you would like to receive a copy or have them send you a copy of the full planning guide, which again today's webinar is largely based on. I also wanted to mention that this latest version of the Temporary Event Planning Guide was adapted from the original version that was published in 1998 that some of you might have seen. And it was published by the Center for Universal Design and the Southeast ADA Center. The updated guide that we're reviewing today was facilitated by the ADA Knowledge Translation Center, and the content was reviewed by technical assistance specialists within the national network of ADA centers. Moving on to slide 13. Some of you on the phone are probably aware of this, but just in case, I wanted to remind everyone that the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, is a federal civil rights law, and it protects the civil rights of people with disabilities in a number of areas, including access to employment, access to state and local government facilities and programs, as well as access to places of public accommodation, which includes private businesses, nonprofit organizations, and it also protects the civil rights of people with disabilities with regards to access to telecommunications. This, of course, also includes access to temporary events, which are often key to community and civic participation. The need for accessibility within temporary events is supported by a number of statistics, but we've pulled a few of them out for you here. The first thing I can mention is that it's estimated that more than 21% of Americans aged 15 and over and 50% of Americans 65 years and older presently have some type of disability. In addition to that, at some point in their lifetime, 70% of all Americans will have either a temporary or a permanent disability. Moving on to slide 14, let's talk for a second about what that means. How does the ADA define a person with a disability? Or in other words, who does the ADA protect? And the ADA really uses what's referred to as a three-prong definition for this term, person with a disability. So the ADA is designed to protect people who have a physical or a mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. First thing I want to mention about this first prong is to keep in mind that the ADA protects, again, those who have physical or mental impairments. Many of us, when we think of the ADA, we may only associate the law with individuals who perhaps have mobility disabilities, when in fact the law absolutely protects those with a mental impairment as well, if it substantially limits one or more major life activities. And a major life activity are those things that you as an able-bodied individual probably do every day, all day long, and don't think twice about. Things like walking and talking and caring for oneself, sleeping and breathing. These are all major life activities. So if you're someone who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, you have rights and are protected under the ADA. The second prong of the definition applies to individuals who have a record of an impairment, physical or mental, that substantially limits one or more major life activities. And finally, the law also applies to individuals who might not have a disability, but they are regarded as such or treated as such, and that individual as well is protected under the ADA. An example of this third prong could perhaps be someone who is involved in a fire and sustained scarring on their face, and they go to apply for a position, perhaps as a hostess at a restaurant, and they're discriminated against, not on the merits of their qualifications to perform the essential functions of the job, but based on their appearance. So even though this facial scarring might not impact one or more major life activities, they're regarded as such, and that individual as well is intended to be protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act. I'm going to move on to slide 15. So when we think about disability awareness, there are some general requirements that are in place in the ADA to protect people with disabilities from discrimination. So for example, under the ADA, entities cannot discriminate on the basis of disability in their areas of programs, services, or activities. You cannot ask unnecessary questions about someone's disability, nor can you deny benefits or services to people with disabilities. You also can't impose eligibility requirements that are intended to segregate or exclude people with disabilities. And finally, you cannot charge people with disabilities extra to cover your costs for things like removing barriers to access or for providing auxiliary aids and services like qualified interpreters. Slide 16. When you are planning for a temporary event, we just wanted to mention that we are focusing today on the ADA. But keep in mind that depending on where you're located in the country or the type of funding that's involved in your temporary event, there could possibly be other codes, standards, even things like human rights laws in your state or city that could also impact access at your event. The first thing I can mention is the Architectural Barriers Act, or the ABA, which requires facilities that are constructed by or leased by the United States or any kind of financing from the federal government, those facilities are required to be accessible to people with disabilities. In addition, if you're a private entity but you accept funding from the federal government, so you're a recipient of federal financial assistance, you also then have an obligation to make sure that your facilities and your programs and your activities are accessible to people with disabilities. And finally, there are many state and local codes, including building codes, that also mandate accessibility as well. So, as I said, we're focusing on the ADA today, but please do be sure to consult and make sure that depending on your funding or on your state or local building code, that you are meeting all of the accessibility obligations that would apply to your project or to your event. Slide 17. We have a few slides here that we've assembled to review just several kinds of disabilities to set a framework, if you will, for planning for an accessible temporary event. And having said that, there, of course, are hundreds of different types of disabilities. You know, while one person may have multiple disabilities, another person may have a single disability with symptoms that, you know, may fluctuate from time to time. So we're just going to review several types of disabilities, if you will, over the next few slides. And we'll start with mobility disabilities, which would include individuals who use wheelchairs, whether they are power-driven or manually operated. This category would also include people with ambulatory mobility disabilities, perhaps individuals who use crutches or canes or walkers or braces, or have artificial limbs would also fall under this category. Now, people who use wheelchairs encounter some of the most obvious access problems, including maneuvering through narrow spaces, going, you know, up or down a steep path or a steep route, and moving over rough or uneven surfaces. They may also experience problems with using common amenities on sites, like toilet rooms or bathing facilities. So some activities that may be difficult for people with mobility disabilities include walking, climbing steps or slopes, even standing for an extended period of time, as well as things that involve fine finger manipulation or reaching. Moving on to slide 18, the next category of disabilities we're going to mention are visual disabilities. And this category includes people with partial vision or total vision loss. And some people with a visual disability are able to distinguish between light and dark or sharp contrasting colors or large print, but they may not be able to read very fine or small print or negotiate or maneuver around, I should say, in dimly lit spaces. So some problems experienced by people with visual impairments can include the ability to orient themselves, how they receive written or graphic information could be problematic, and using controls that are not adequately labeled. And they also may have a hard time avoiding hazardous protruding objects if they don't have cane detection. And we'll talk more about that requirement in a second. Slide 19. The next category to consider are individuals with hearing disabilities. And people in this category use a number of methods to compensate for their inability to hear sound. Some people with partial hearing may depend on hearing aids or lip reading, while others who are totally deaf may use speech reading or another means of communication that's commonly known as American Sign Language. Some problems for people with hearing impairments include communicating with many hearing people and using equipment that was really designed exclusively for auditory processing, things like telephones and fire alarms. Additionally, a lack of sign language interpreters or other auxiliary aids or services, or even inadequately trained sign language interpreters can also be a problem for people with hearing disabilities. Slide 20. The last category that I'm going to mention, and please remember this is not meant to be an exhaustive list. There are many more types of disabilities. But the last one that I'm going to mention right now includes individuals with cognitive disabilities as well as other hidden disabilities, those disabilities that aren't obvious to the naked eye. So some of these include cognitive and/or learning abilities and can affect someone's ability to understand or communicate or their behavior. Some examples are seizure disorders as well as those who have multiple chemical sensitivities. People with cognitive disabilities, when you're planning for an event, may have difficulty navigating your facility, particularly where your signage system is not clear or if you have a very complicated signage system. For people who have seizure disorders, they may be sensitive to features in the environment, like lighting, which can activate seizures. And another hidden condition that's gaining greater awareness is multiple chemical sensitivity. And people with this condition experience a physical reaction that usually affects breathing when they come in contact with a chemical or a combination of chemicals that can be present in buildings and different types of products, including things like pesticides, room deodorants, and even cologne or perfume that could be worn by other, you know, event attendees. And the reactions that people with multiple chemical sensitivity have can range anywhere from mild to sometimes life-threatening. Moving on to slide 21. Now we're going to discuss planning for access at temporary events. And what you see on this slide is a list of some of the many temporary events that take place every day in communities across the country. Temporary events are intended to celebrate and support a sense of community and must encourage participation by all people. And this, of course, should include people with disabilities. Slide 22. We're going to start with a quick review of the items that should be addressed prior to site selection and things that should be considered throughout the entire planning process, so that people with disabilities are able to ultimately participate in this temporary event. And, you know, planning ahead is key for several obvious reasons, one of them being that it's the most cost-effective way to ensure accessibility. It may also be helpful to consider designating an accessibility coordinator, someone who is there to oversee all phases of the event, from the planning stage to completion of the event. And this is something to consider, especially for larger events where you may have many elements that need to be addressed. So you see on the screen here those activities that we're trying to make sure are accessible for event attendees. It may include the ability to obtain information and directions prior to the event, the ability to arrive at the site in the same way as others. So thinking about event attendees, are they coming in car? Are they coming by public transportation, by taxi? If you have parking, we need to think about accessible parking and where will that be located, and how do we get from accessible parking to our entrances. And then once we're on site, how do guests, where do they go, I should say, to obtain additional information and directions about any accessible features. Moving on to slide 23, we also want to think about how are people going to circulate throughout the event. And if people are attending performances and, you know, engaging in activities and exhibits, how are they going to be accessible with those various types of disabilities that I just mentioned? Can people get to ancillary items like concession stands and use toilet facilities and water fountains? So these are all things that we're going to be thinking about throughout the planning phase. And during this phase, you may want to reach out to people with disabilities to see if they can assist you early on in the process, and that's key. And maybe even consider setting up an advisory committee that is representative of a number of types of disabilities to make sure that you are indeed being as inclusive as possible. You can always contact your local Centers for Independent Living. They are an excellent resource for information like this. And if it's a very large event, particularly if it's a large event and you know there may be a need for extensive architectural modifications, you may even want to consider hiring a firm or an individual with both accessibility and architectural design experience, particularly if you have a site that may have a lot of challenges to accessibility. On slide 24, site selection. Now, this probably has the greatest overall impact on accessibility to your event, as you know, inaccessible architectural features are probably the most difficult barriers to remove. So site selection certainly is key in planning your event. While a lot of facilities throughout the country today were built before the passage of the ADA, even some sites that are partially accessible can be improved with proper planning. I also want to mention that if you are narrowing down sites where you know, you're thinking of hosting an event, please do consider accessibility as a primary decision-making factor in ultimately choosing a site. It truly is that important. So it's critical to assess your sites for access, to identify any barriers to accessibility, and then to determine what kinds of modifications may be needed. One of the best methods to do that, if you're not someone who's using a firm or an outside company to assist you, is by using the ADA checklist that you see on the slide here, developed by the National Network and the Institute for Human-Centered Design. And you can access the checklist at adachecklist.org. Again, it's an excellent resource to use if you are going out and evaluating a site for accessibility. This checklist will walk you through the process of how to do that. And again, using a checklist like this in consultation with your local Center for Independent Living and other groups of that represent people with disabilities should ultimately help you locate an accessible site and note those areas that may need improvement. Moving on to slide 25. After reviewing the site, when you're going through the site selection process, you know, you may determine that some accessibility features are indeed lacking. And the United States Department of Justice, that's the federal agency that enforces Title II and Title III of ADA, has assembled some common steps to improve accessibility that are generally deemed what's known as readily achievable or easily accomplishable without much difficulty or expense. So you can see a number of those recommendations on the screen here. And they include some obvious recommendations like installing ramps and providing curb cuts, repositioning items on shelving, and then there's even some toilet room specific recommendations, like installing a raised toilet seat, insulating the pipes under the lavatory, installing grab bars. So these are just some of the recommendations for modifications, but again, the checklist that I just mentioned will also provide you with additional item-specific recommendations for improvement. I also want to mention here that both Title II, which applies to state and local government, if they were to host the municipal government was to host a temporary event, Title II of the ADA would apply to that event and requires that any programs or activities sponsored by state or local government entities are accessible to people with disabilities. So ideally, you would like to have an accessible site. Sometimes you can relocate programs or services to alternate sites if one site is not accessible. But ultimately, any modifications that must be made that aren't an undue burden to achieve must be facilitated. And then even for private businesses or organizations that decide to host temporary events, they have an obligation under Title III of the ADA to remove barriers to access if it is readily achievable for them to do so. And they do not have an option of just relocating to an alternate location as Title II entities have. And remember, those barriers that are readily achievable to address hinge on many factors, one of them being cost, the extent and the cost to eliminate a barrier, as well as the financial resources of the entity. So if a large multinational corporation is hosting an event, certainly we can assume that they have more financial resources to use to improve accessibility than a small community nonprofit might have. If they are trying to address accessibility at a temporary event. Slide 26. Temporary versus permanent modifications. So under Title II of the ADA, entities must make permanent architectural modifications to ensure that program access is achieved for people with disabilities unless it proves to be an undue burden to do so, meaning doing so would be excessively difficult or expensive. Sometimes it may be worth an attempt to negotiate with a landlord or a facility owner to see if you can incorporate accessibility improvements into the signing of a rental contract for a space. That's something that often can be negotiated ahead of time prior to site selection. Sometimes permanent changes to a site, frankly, will not be able to be made, nor can you relocate the event. At that point in time, it's when you need to consider temporary modifications and how can they be put in place to support the needs of people with disabilities. The last thing I want to mention here before I pass it off to Rob is that sometimes, you know, we're going to talk a lot today about physical accessibility, but we also need to be mindful of our policies and procedures to ensure that we are modifying them as needed to support the needs of people with disabilities. So, for example, you may have a event space that has a no pets policy. We want to make sure that prior to our event, that the management and staff at that event understand that we will permit, you know, qualified service animals on the premises despite having a no pets policy in place. And that's just one example. But we don't want to only focus on physical access. We also want to look at our policies and procedures as well. And with that, I'm going to advance to slide 27 and pass this over to Rob.
Thank you, Jennifer. Jennifer spoke briefly on program access for Title II and access to goods and services under Title III. I'd like to remind everybody, under the ADA standards, both temporary and permanent structures must be accessible, and this is a citation. So whether you're building restrooms or temporary stages, they must be accessible and they must follow the standards. Slide 28. Let's talk about getting to the event. I always encourage people when they're doing surveys to go out to the street, go out to the sidewalk, and then look for your accessible paths of travel back in from wherever it might be, whether it be the transit stop, the bus stop, your accessible parking areas, your drop-off areas. Is there accessible path of travel back into the facility? If there isn't, what things can you do to make it accessible? Slide 29. Many times the accessible path of travel or the accessible entrance isn't readily visible or readily apparent, so signage is very critical. However, I wouldn't label restrooms ADA restrooms. Everybody on this phone call probably knows what an ADA restroom is, but I would bet the general public does not. I would suggest just the international symbol of accessibility, a little wheelchair symbol, and an arrow indicating whether it be a restroom, parking. That should be sufficient. I would drop the ADA. Next slide is 30. Some various things you need to look for when you're accessing your site, as far as your sidewalks and accessible routes. First off, at least 36 inches wide and at least 80 inches of headroom. So somebody who's blind or low vision doesn't run into branches or overhead signs. Watch out for tripping hazards. Anything over a quarter inch can be a tripping hazard. And these can be caused by sidewalks heaving, et cetera. On to slide 31. Again, things you look for. Overhead branches that are hanging down. Have them trimmed back. Is there loose gravel? Then choose a different path or find a hardened surface. Is there tree limbs, or in the case of the far right picture, are they so overhanging they actually block it so a person using a wheelchair or even somebody standing and walking down through there can't get past that bush. If so, you need to trim it back. On the slide 32, curb ramps will be part of your accessible route of travel. What are the slopes? Maximum should be no more than 1 in 12, or 8.33%. If you need to get a, you can probably borrow a smart level from somebody out there, or you can actually take measurements of that. And there's some good instructions on the DOJ website under accessing polling places as a way to measure a slope without buying an expensive smart level. On to slide 33, if there aren't curb cuts on the path of travel you chose, you can either build your own out of a temporary just build a temporary wood ramp, or you may be able to rent or purchase a portable curb ramp. Slide 34. Many times barricades are used to either define accessible parking places, accessible routes, or block off various areas. Just make sure there is an accessible path of travel 36 inches wide through those barriers if that's where you want your public to go. On to slide 35. For the number of parking places you're required to provide, just go back to the 2010 ADA standards. In chapter 2 of it, the scoping, which is basically where, when, and how many, and you'll get there's a chart there as far as how many accessible parking places you need to provide for the number of parking spaces in your facility or at your event. Things I'd watch for is parking area level. And when I mean level, I mean no more than a 2% running slope or cross slope in any direction. Is there an access aisle for each accessible space? And are there van accessible spaces? I'll go into detail a little further on here. In slide 36, is the accessible parking space level? As we see in the photo to the left here, I'm parked on a very severe slope here, and it's difficult to transfer from my wheelchair back into the vehicle when you're parked on a slope. Additionally, your wheelchair could easily take off from you and roll away. Additionally, if there's a build-up curb ramp, as we see in the picture on the right, it makes a very unlevel surface to unload a wheelchair or deploy a lift from a van. So there's only a couple items you need to look for when you're assessing or when you're evaluating your accessible parking spaces. Then you need to look for, is there an access aisle for each space? Access aisle, briefly, you need those to be able to open your door fully to unload a wheelchair, your walker. You also need those access aisles to deploy a lift. So two spaces can share the same access aisle, but each space does need one on one side or the other. The left-hand side of the picture here, we see City Market. There are no access aisles whatsoever. On to slide 38. To make a van accessible space, either you can add 3 feet to the accessible parking space or 3 feet to your access aisle. So in other words, you can have 11-foot wide space and a 5-foot wide access aisle, or an 8-foot wide parking space with an 8-foot wide access aisle. However, I would discourage that on to slide 39, because the 8-foot wide access aisle, people love to park in them, as you see here in this photo. So I would encourage a 5-foot access aisle and 11-foot wide van accessible space. On to slide 40, parking garages. If they're part of your event site, you'll need to take a look at them. Your van accessible spaces can be clustered in one area. However, you will need to provide a vehicle route to those accessible spaces that provides at least 98 inches of clearance from the entrance all the way to those van spaces, including the van space themselves. If your parking garage just isn't tall enough, the existing older parking garage, then you'll need to create van accessible parking somewhere else on the site. On to slide 31, parking signage. Under the ADA, your regular accessible parking spaces, all they need is the International Symbol of Accessibility, the wheelchair symbol. For your van accessible spaces, they need the wheelchair symbol and a sign that says van accessible. That's it under the ADA. You'll have to look to local and state laws for any additional information you need to provide. But under the ADA, that's it. So reserve parking, handicap parking, by the way, which I would avoid using. It's accessible parking, by the way. Any signs, that's all local and state ordinance. On to slide 41. This is a letter law. Back to the ADA standards. Temporary and permanent structures, so even temporary parking, shall follow the guidelines to the letter. And in many DOJ publications, they have the access aisle well-defined with cones or barriers, nice wide spots, and curb ramps. That's the letter of the law. On to slide 43. However, this is probably the best I've seen out there. And if anybody has anything better that they've witnessed or seen, please take a picture and send it to me. In this case here, this is in Quartzsite, Arizona at a gym show. They did a pretty good job considering. Not to the letter of the law, but they did. They tried. They made fairly wide parking spaces, accessible parking spaces. It's the gravel parking lot is pretty tightly, looks like they may use crusher fine, so it has a fairly stable, firm surface there. They outline the various parking spaces with chalk or with the chalk they use like for athletic fields, and they do have signage there, says reserved parking. So I do have to give them kudos. Doesn't meet the letter of the law, but they tried. They gave it their best shot. Maintenance. This applies to maintenance for anything. It may be a little difficult to see in this photo here, but if you look to the right, underneath that tent, behind that picket fence, is an accessible parking space. This business chose to put their picnic tables, their outdoor eating area there instead. So obviously a violation of the ADA. But maintenance is a huge issue out there. It may be accessible when the event first starts, but somebody else may come along and decide they should use that accessible space or that curb ramp for something else, and it destroys or eliminates access to that event. On the slide 45, then you need to look at your drop-off areas and evaluate them. You need to look at your bus stops, your passenger drop-off areas, whether it be taxi, private shuttles, or private vehicles. Are they accessible? Is there an accessible path of travel to them, to the entrance? On slide 46, for your passenger loading zone, watch for a vertical clearance. You'll need 114 inches. The vertical clearance. The area needs to be at least 20 foot long and a 60-inch wide access aisle for deploying lifts, and it must be at the same level as the parking space itself. And most importantly, it must be connected to the accessible route to get you to your event itself. Slide 47, you need to evaluate your bus and transit stops. is there an accessible route of travel to your event? In this case here, this was in San Antonio. I took a little road trip, a bus trip out to the McKay Museum while I was at a symposium. As you can see here, the bus stop itself is fairly accessible. Nice concrete, but there's no connecting path. If you look in the far distance there, you see a blue sign. That's the entrance to the McKay Museum, and there is no way to get there except to go in the street. So probably have a couple different choices. You can talk to your city and have them create an accessible path of travel to your event, if it's especially like an event that's going to be held there every year, or maybe you convince your transit organization to drop off people at your event, at least temporarily, or as a temporary solution. On to slide 48. You can also create temporary passenger loading zones if you need to, by using various bollards, barriers, cones, barrels. You may even have to put down some mats or some type of surface to make that drop-off area accessible. And again, it needs to be 20 foot long, have an unloading area at least 60 inches wide, and connect to an accessible path of travel. Jennifer, I think this is your slide at 49.
Yep, thank you. Thank you very much, Rob. Just continuing on with what Rob was just mentioning, you know, once people with disabilities are able to arrive at the site, we then need to focus on how are they going to navigate through the event site. And an accessible route that you see here is a critical component to the successful use of a site. So what you see here are, again, the basic features of an accessible route. Our minimum clear width of 36 inches. Ideally, you have more than that. But your minimum clear width of 36 inches, which could be reduced to 32 inches, as long as it's not for a distance greater than 24 inches. So when you're going through an accessible doorway, our accessible clear width, again, can be reduced to 32 inches. You also want to ensure that if you do have a narrow accessible route, that at reasonable intervals, generally not in excess of 200 feet, you provide space for someone using a wheelchair to turn around or passing space, which must be a minimum of 5 feet by 5 feet. So keep in mind these accessible routes throughout your site and these minimum clear widths that are addressed here. Moving on to slide 50. Getting around the site, here's another slide that I think illustrates a lot of the points that Rob was just mentioning. If you take a look, like an overhead view, if you will, of the accessible parking and the bus transit stop as people are arriving at the site in shaded gray, you can see the temporary measures that were put into place to provide for an accessible route, as well as temporary accessible parking improvements, including the crosswalk that was made accessible with the use of portable curb ramp, crossing the drive aisle there, and then even the creation of a temporary accessible passenger loading zone, all routes, if you will, leading to the accessible entrance. One thing to keep in mind here is when it comes to accessible routes, to the maximum extent feasible, we always want to try to ensure that the route used by people with disabilities is not circuitous or longer when compared to the route that's used by the general public. So we really do want to try to alleviate unnecessary travel distances for people with disabilities. Slide 51. Here you see some of the more basic space requirements, if you will, for individuals who use wheelchairs. So whether you have a room or space at your temporary event, or a display or an exhibit, you want to be mindful of these minimum, and again, these are just minimums, spatial requirements for people who use wheelchairs. First thing I'll point out is the minimum clear floor ground space for someone using a wheelchair, which is 30 inches minimum by 48 inches minimum in length. And this is the space needed to accommodate a single wheelchair and its occupant. Next to that, you see a detail of a 60-inch turning diameter, which allows someone, again, to make a turn. In the alternative, if you don't have the 60-inch turning diameter, you can provide what's known as a T-turn space, similar to performing a three-point turn in your car. And this can be provided at the intersection of a hall or a corridor, sometimes between display cases, even sometimes under a counter, for instance, if you have tow clearance. So these are just some very basic space requirements that you want to be mindful of when setting up your temporary event. Slide 52. Another thing to be aware of throughout the event site, not just along your accessible routes, but throughout all of your interior and exterior circulation paths, is the presence of what are known as protruding objects. And protruding objects are really any element that can be hazardous for people who are blind or individuals who have low vision or, frankly, sometimes people who just might not be paying attention. You can see several photographs here, one of a television monitor, some drinking fountains, a hand dryer, a wall sconce. The one thing all these elements have in common is that their leading edges are mounted higher than 27 inches above the floor, and they protrude more than 4 inches from the wall or from the corridor. Because of those two elements being in place, if somebody who is blind is walking along these corridors and sweeping their cane in front of them, these objects will not be detectable by their cane. And because of that, they then become hazardous, and somebody can potentially walk into these items. So, what we're told in the ADA standards is that we need to identify these protruding objects and provide some form of cane detection underneath of them. ADA doesn't tell you exactly what that cane detection must be, but you would want to ensure that it's something that is not likely to move. You also want to be mindful, if in the case of a drinking fountain, you don't want to place something directly under the wheelchair accessible fountain, as that could then create more of a problem. So you'd want to provide cane detection on the side, in that case, of the drinking fountain. And of course, ideally at the time of construction, if you are involved at that phase, you wouldn't want to purchase wall sconces that do not have cane detection underneath that protrude more than 4 inches into a circulation pad. With regard to temporary events, where you may have a lot of tents or tarps or similar temporary structures, you want to be mindful of the guy wires for those kinds of structures and make sure that they are going to be detectable for people who are blind or people who have low vision as well. Slide 53. So here we're going to talk for a moment about the ground and floor surfaces of our accessible route. There are several key features highlighted here. The first one I'll mention is, anytime you have an accessible route, you are permitted to have a vertical change in level, meaning that's not rounded or beveled. That's up to a quarter inch maximum in height. However, once you have a vertical change in level that exceeds a quarter inch, up to a half an inch, at that point in time, that change in level can be troublesome for somebody using a mobility device. So we're going to have to bevel that change in level with the slope no greater than 1 to 2, as you can see here. In addition, you may have grates or openings in the floor. If you do, or in the ground, those openings should not be more than a half an inch wide. If they are, they can become problematic for someone who uses a cane or crutches. So you would want to investigate, at a minimum, is it possible to cover up that grate just for your event, if there's nothing else you can do to solve that problem. Now, when we talk about ground and floor surfaces, Rob had a photo of loose asphalt with his parking area, and I'm sure many of you can imagine that rolling over, irregular surfaces can be troublesome for people with disabilities. So can rolling over soft surfaces or deep pile carpeting. That can also be problematic, as can sand and gravel. Even for people who use power wheelchairs or scooters, they can also have difficulty on these surfaces because it requires extra force to travel across them, which can then drain your batteries quickly and wind up leaving somebody stranded. irregular surfaces like cobblestones that you see, you know, here in this photograph, or uneven brick or concrete pavers can also be difficult. I'm not going to say you can't ever have pavers. That would not be true. But going back to Rob's point about maintenance, you absolutely want to make sure that if you have uneven surfaces, that they are maintained properly to alleviate any, you know, great changes in level that could become a problem for people who use mobility devices. For temporary events, it's possible that you may have things like crushed stone or soil as your ground surface. If it's compact, if it's stable, and doesn't have a lot of loose debris, it very well could be a usable surface where you could host a temporary event. If your surface is grass, that may work, assuming that the soil isn't soaking wet and that the grass is cut short. Tall grass could be slippery and really difficult to maneuver over if you use a wheelchair. You also have to think about how the weather is going to affect your ground surface. You know, grass in a dry temperature that's cut short could be great, but could also be very slippery and muddy in the event of rain. So you want to plan for that, you know, whether it's purchasing tents to protect the ground or perhaps purchasing synthetic mats, as you see in the photograph on the right, that can be used throughout your event you know, to provide your accessible routes. So these are just some of the things you want to keep in mind regarding ground and floor surfaces. Slide 54. At your accessible entrances, of course, you know, your accessible route can never involve the use of stairs. So if you need to investigate temporary measures, one of the things that may work is the use of a portable ramp. If you have an inaccessible building entrance and you cannot provide a permanent ramp, then installing a portable ramp may be something that you can do. Many facilities have door vestibule areas with two sets of double doors, and the ADA standards require that we have a minimum of 48 inches of clearance between the swing of these doors. However, in an older facility, you may not have that 48 inches, so, you know, maybe investigate whether one of those doors can be propped open or removed for your event to improve access. If your facility has revolving doors, those are never accessible. So you want to ensure that you do have an auxiliary door, preferably adjacent to the inaccessible revolving door. And if you have to access things like turnstiles, those are not accessible either. So you want to make sure you have an additional auxiliary gate adjacent to the turnstile. Slide 55. Temporary ramps, you know, the same requirements that apply to a permanent ramp are also going to come into play and apply to a temporary ramp. So if you do purchase or rent a portable manufactured ramp, there are several key technical specifications that you want to look for, including a minimum clear width of 36 inches, which is the same, you know, for an accessible route, and you take that measurement between the handrails on the ramp. You'd also want to make sure that your slope complies with the ADA standards. The running slope does not exceed 1 to 12, or 8.33%. Your cross slope as well, you know, you don't want to exceed 2% there. You also can have no more than 30 inches of rise in your ramp run before you have a landing, you know, or a rest area for someone to use. And even things like your handrail extensions are going to come into play. Slide 56. Oh, you know what? If I can go back, I did want to mention, so temporary ramps may be purchased. If you have a significant rise to overcome, you know, much more than 3 steps as you see here, you may at that point want to investigate a temporary platform lift. This may be something if you just don't have the space that you need to install a compliant temporary ramp, or if you did put in a ramp, the slope would exceed 1 to 12. You may at that point want to investigate purchasing a lift. Many times you can contact your local Centers for Independent Living or perhaps your local medical equipment dealers. They may be able to point you in the right direction to where you can rent a temporary lift, you know, in that situation where you have an excessive rise to overcome. Slide 56, elevators. Of course, if you have an elevator and you have a multi-level facility, That's excellent. So if you are using something like the ADA checklist that we mentioned, you will be able to assess the size of the cab and see if that's adequate. But you also want to check for additional accessible features, particularly if guests at the event are going to be independently using the elevators. It may include making sure that you have raised characters and braille features on the control panels, on the signage, indicating the floor levels on the elevator jams. So these are just some additional things that you would want to check if there are elevators on site. Slide 57. So all along our accessible route, throughout the event site, any time people encounter a doorway, it is required to meet certain minimum requirements. One of them being, and most of those minimum requirements are highlighted here on this slide. Minimum clear width of 32 inches, and you would check that by opening the door to a 90-degree angle and then measuring from the face of the door to the opposing stop and make sure that you have at least 32 inches of clear width. You also want to check for the closing speed, depending on the type of whether you have a closer or spring hinges, the ADA standards will tell you the closing speed. Obviously, people with some mobility disabilities may take a little longer to go through a door, so you want to make sure that door is not closing quicker than it should. You want to check the pounds of force required to either push or pull interior doors and make sure if they have closers on them. Sometimes you can have the facility staff adjust the closers to ensure that those interior doors maybe can require less pressure to operate. You also want to look at things like the accessible hardware on your doors, a smooth surface on the bottom of the door on the push side. People might be using the front casters of their wheelchair or footrest to push the door open. Be mindful of your thresholds, that they don't exceed a half an inch. And then also look for maneuvering clearance on both sides of the door. Maneuvering clearance is that yellow rectangle that you see in the figure on the right. And maneuvering clearance really is nothing more than the space that people need if you're using a mobility device to get close enough and grab the hardware and push or pull that door. So you want to make sure you have that. Sometimes in older facilities, if you don't have that 32 inches of clear width that I mentioned, you can investigate either removing a door or installing offset or swing away hinges, which can, you know, sometimes buy you, you know, anywhere between 1.5 to 2 inches of additional clear width at a door. And you see that pictured on the screen here. Moving on to slide 58. We're going to move on now to publicizing your temporary event and some considerations for access. So print materials are generally usable, you know, for people who can see and read, but you also want to think about people with disabilities. So because of this, you may want to use a variety of publicity formats and media options to ensure that you are reaching the largest audience possible. And certainly your local disability groups and organizations are there and generally are willing to help you with publicity of your event. Slide 59. So here you see some of the various types of modes for accessibility and publicizing your event. They include, of course, broadcast media. If you can do this, that's wonderful. You just want to make sure that your TV announcements should also be accompanied by captioning or on-screen text. If you are using internet-based communication like websites and social media, you want to make sure that any images or audible information is also accompanied with text to make it accessible to people with hearing or vision disabilities. And then in terms of printed information, you want to make sure that you're using large typefaces with high contrast that are easy to read. Slide 60. You want to be prepared as you're publicizing the event to respond to questions that you may get about accessibility. And this is going to include the ability to accept calls from things like a relay service. So you want to be prepared to respond to these questions, especially if your publicity materials can't provide very complete details about the event. So if it's a large event and you have a variety of accessibility issues, at that point it may be best to have someone on staff who's the designated knowledgeable person, perhaps your ADA coordinator, who's on hand to respond to inquiries about accessibility at your event. You also want to prepare your staff and any volunteers that you have and make it clear to them that people with disabilities expect to be treated just like all other event participants. You want to advise them of some things that include how they view and interact with people with disabilities, to avoid being anxious or overly protective. Let people know on your staff that some event attendees may need extra time to move, speak, or perform a task. And make sure that your staff is well aware of the accessibility features, including where the accessible routes are, where the accessible toilet rooms are, as well as TTYs and ramps and other features related to access. Slide 62. So generally, think inclusion. This certainly is the emphasis for all activities. I do want to point out, however, there are some cases where having separate divisions, depending on your event, may actually allow people with disabilities to participate in a more equal manner. So perhaps you're having a marathon competition. If that's the case, then having a wheelchair division that is separate from the men's and women's divisions may actually allow people with disabilities to participate more fully in that specific event. However, you may have other runners who use braces or artificial limbs who want to compete in the other men's and women's divisions. So think about your policies and procedures in this case. Having a flexible policy that can allow people with disabilities to choose the division in which they feel most comfortable is going to go a long way in supporting the notion of inclusion in the event. Taking part in the event, if your event has displays and exhibits, you want to think about those things that Rob and I had mentioned previously about accessible routes and clear floor space, making sure that people with disabilities have physical access to your display tables, to your cases, to your shelves. You also want to make sure that people with visual disabilities are able to touch objects on display and make sure that people with hearing disabilities have access to content, particularly of presentations, AV presentations. You can do this by providing captioning, or subtitles, or a written script. Moving on to slide 64. If your resources permit you, and particularly if it's a larger event, you may want to prepare ahead of time some brochures, maps, or schedules in large print for people who may have low vision, and you want to make this information readily available at your service counters, at your information desks. If you have a ticket counter, you should have at least one section or one ticket window that has a lower counter that's at least 36 inches long, no more than 36 inches high, that is dedicated to serving guests with disabilities or those of short stature. And I think Rob probably mentioned this, and I'm going to reiterate, can't stress enough the importance of accessible signage, particularly if you don't have fully accessible routes throughout the event site. You really want to take advantage of using directional signage, generally with the international symbol of accessibility, so that people are aware of accessible routes and accessible features at your event. If you have performing areas, like stages and speakers platforms, keep in mind that speakers or performers with disabilities may need modifications to stages. High stages are obviously going to be more difficult to make accessible, and it is generally not acceptable or safe to carry a person with a disability up steps. So if the stage is very high and you cannot provide ramps access to it, you then may want to investigate that portable lift that I mentioned before. You also want to make sure that your presenters that have hearing, speech, or vision disabilities let you know before the event of any auxiliary aids or services that they may be in need of in order to effectively communicate their message with the audience. And microphones. It's key to provide, table microphones, lapel or lavalier mics are sometimes of great use to people with mobility disabilities. You might find that you have to raise a mic by placing it on blocks or on a mic stand. But providing amplification of sound is key for many event attendees. Slide 67, you also want to think about the seating layout. There's many, many options for layout. However, I think some of the most popular are seen here. Classroom style on the left, theater style in the middle, and then open seating layout to the far right of the screen. All of these can work, you know, for temporary events. You just want to be mindful of the accessible route to the accessible seating area, maintaining clear floor or ground space. And if you have an open layout, like maybe at the free concert at the public park where there isn't a defined seating area, you may want to try to identify the most level area of the park that's closest to an accessible route and perhaps mark that off as the accessible seating area for your guests with disabilities. If you have amenities on site, including things like vendors and concession areas, you want to make sure that they are located on an accessible route, that you have clear floor space, at least 30 by 48 inches, you know, adjacent to things like your soda dispensers and your ketchup packets and your mustard and sugar. You also want to make sure those elements are located within accessible reach ranges. And when you're training your staff, you know, include your vendors and your concession stands in on that training and let them know that it's expected that they will provide assistance as needed to guests with disabilities. Now, for communication access, again, you want to think about various types of people with disabilities, including hearing disabilities, and investigate if you will need to provide sign language interpreters or written materials or assisted listening devices. You also want to think about guests with visual disabilities. And given your presentations that may be occurring or your exhibits, do you need audio descriptions or recordings or braille materials? And you also want to make sure that as much as possible for those with cognitive disabilities that you are providing very clear and concise language as well as graphic presentations and, if necessary, repeating information that's being relayed. So just to follow up on that point, you know, you want to think about assisted listening systems, sign language interpreters, audio descriptions, as well as seating options. Sometimes if people are lip reading, they're going to want to be seated in the front of the room, closest to the speaker. So these are all things to take into consideration. And I also finally want to mention before I pass things back off to Rob, access for people with environmental sensitivities or intolerances. And this is just a few consideration points. There are many more. But you should consider having a fragrance, smoke, and pesticide-free environment. Events should be posted and advertised as being fragrance, smoke, and pesticide-free. Promulgate that policy. Make sure your event site is a non-smoking facility. And do not use things like fresh flowers, as they can be problematic. If you want to learn more about planning events and the considerations for people with environmental or chemical sensitivities, you can contact the National Center for Environmental Health Strategies, and I've included their contact information in our resources section at the end of this presentation so that you can contact them to learn more. With that, I'm going to pass it off to Rob again.
Thank you, Jennifer. Seems like I spend so much time in toilets as far as measuring for accessibility. I put together so many wheelchair access guides over the years. Our parent corporation meeting challenge sends us surveys. Anyway, so much to look at, so much to deal with. I'm just going to hit some of the highlights of what you need to look for. Anyway, if toilet facilities are provided, they shall be accessible. Period, shall be accessible. Some of the things I look for toilets is doors in the vestibules. That's the first thing you're hung up on. If it's going to be inaccessible, that's probably where it's going to be inaccessible. So watch for doors that don't provide that 32 inches of clearance. As Jennifer said earlier, swing clear hinges can work, and give you another 1.5 to 2 inches of clearance getting through that door. As you can see in the picture that I have posted here on slide 73, my wheelchair is hitting that door frame, hitting that jamb, and I just can't get through it. Believe it or not, Lowe's, the hardware store, actually starts stocking these swing clear hinges, and they're relatively inexpensive. As you see in the lower photo, anywhere from $5 to $7 you can pick these up at. I found these at a Lowe's hardware store here in Colorado. So an option for you, may give you a little bit more clearance, a little more accessibility. Let's go on to slide 74. The other issue a lot of times with older facilities is the vestibule, kind of the double doors as you're going into a restroom. Jennifer explained this in detail earlier. Basically, I'll just talk about a solution here for a restroom. You may have to prop those doors open, remove one door. If you prop both of them open, you may need a privacy curtain or privacy screen on the outside of the restroom, as we see in the right-hand drawing. Without a privacy screen there, everybody could look right into the restroom, right to the urinals. Not a pretty sight that none of us need to look at. So anyway, various solutions you can make that situation more accessible. On to slide 75. Other things we need to look at in restrooms, is there a 5-foot turning diameter so you can turn around and get out of the facility? Other things, are there trash cans in the way, especially in maneuvering clearances? As we see in the photograph on the left-hand side, that trash can is going to be in the way exiting that restroom. Is there someplace else in that restroom you can place that trash can? In this case, it's a 55-gallon barrel. Maybe just a smaller barrel might be appropriate. On to slide 76, toilet stalls. The things you look for is the width. It needs to be at least 60 inches wide and between 56 and 59 inches deep, depending on if the toilet is floor or wall mounted. On to slide 77, watch out for your long, skinny stalls. For your older facilities, they may meet the letter of the law, but they're really unusable. The one on the left there, you see the picture of me from an overhead view. I'm entering the stall, and you have grab bars on both sides there, but to do a transfer, to actually get on that toilet, is nearly impossible. Now, I might be able to enter my leg bag in that toilet, but that's about it. I would not be able to transfer onto the toilet itself. I know they meet the absolute letter of the law for existing facilities, but they're nearly worthless. So I'd really encourage you to convert a couple stalls, as we see in slide 78. Combine a couple stalls and make a truly accessible one. That's about the only way to do it. As we see here in the drawing, also notice that the door, the stall door, opens on the open side of the toilet. So as you enter the toilet stall, you can enter all the way in and not have to worry about running into the water closet, the toilet itself. Moving on to slide 79. The next thing we need to look for in restrooms are the lavatories. Are the sinks accessible? Watch out for 27 inches of knee clearance. Do they have round, if they have round faucet nozzles, replace them with lever handles. That's something cheap and easy to do. And probably something that should have been done, 25 years ago or so. Anyway, on to slide 80. Dispensers, whether it be paper towel dispensers, soap dispensers. Generally, the reach range is a maximum of 48 inches. However, if you're reaching over a counter, as we see in this photograph here, the highest reach range is limited to 44 inches. And that's to the highest operable part. In this case, for the soap dispenser, it'd be the lever to dispense that soap. Moving on to slide 81, then you look for mirrors. If they're above a counter, maximum 40 inches tall, or maximum 40 inches to the bottom of the reflective surface. Any taller than that, I'm a tall guy sitting in my wheelchair, so I see the top of my head, and that's about it. If they're anywhere else in the facility, on a wall that's not above the counter, then the maximum for the lowest edge should be no higher than 35 inches. Moving on to slide 82. If portable toilets are provided, porta-potties, porta-johns, at least 5% must be accessible. That's within the 2010 standards. That is a requirement. Moving on to slide 83. Some things to look for when you're looking at your portable toilet units. Many times, sometimes they think they just throw some, they combine two, they throw a wheelchair symbol on the door, throw some grab bars inside, and call it good. Well, you really need to watch out for those long, skinny units. They're probably not truly accessible. You need to look for units that have the 5-foot turning radius in it. That's what's required. As we see here in this picture of a modern, new, accessible toilet, you can almost see where that 5-foot turning radius has been kind of cut out as far as the receptacle that holds the waste. So that's what you need to look out for. Avoid the small, skinny units and get the big, square ones that actually are truly accessible. Let's move on to slide 84. Other things you need to watch out for with your portable units is if there's a ramp that ends right at the door. The ramp goes right over the door, there is no level landing. So basically, if you're a wheelchair user, a crush user, whatever, you roll up the door, you grab the door, and then you have to back downhill with it and then wheel through it. A difficult maneuver for anybody. So watch out for those ramps that end with no level landing at the top. Moving on to slide 85. Watch for the accessible paths, or in this case, no accessible path to the porta potty. And look for the transition between your accessible route and the porta potty itself. You may have loose gravel or grass that's getting soggy or non-compacted from so many people going in and out of the porta potty. So watch out for that transition. You may have to put down some plywood or some other fabric there to make that transition accessible. Let's move on to slide 86. Is there drinking water available? If drinking water is provided, it shall be accessible. Best practice, of course, is provide water for everybody, whether they be persons with disability or your general public. Like I said today earlier, it's almost 90 here in Colorado. Any time out in that weather at 90 degrees, I get dehydrated very quickly. So best practice, try to provide it for everybody. For drinking fountains, watch for high-low fountains. Under the 2010 standards are required, a lower fountain for children and people using wheelchairs. And the higher ones are people who have difficulty bending over. Look to the standards for specific heights. Look to the checklist for both specific heights and what to evaluate. If it's an existing facility, your fountain is just too high or too low, think about providing paper cup dispensers to at least make that temporary event accessible during the duration of the event. Moving on to slide 89. Shelters are not specifically required, but as best practice, I sure would provide it. It gives a person with a disability your elderly a real break from the sunshine, especially on hot days, or a rainy environment as we see in the east. So best practice, consider doing that. Jennifer, I believe this is on to you for resources.
Yes, thank you, Rob. We've assembled a few resources here that might be of assistance to you. And the first I'm going to mention is, of course, the ADA National Network. You can reach your local ADA center by calling 1-800-949-4232 or visit the website at adata.org. If you are looking for information and guidance regarding assistive technology, assistivetech.net, you can contact them as well as Able Data. They have a number of products related to accessibility. You can also reach out to, you can look for a lot of these resources online, but the National Disability Rights Network can point you in the right direction for your local protection and advocacy organization. Might be able to assist you if you're looking to improve access at your event or even publicize the event. And if you're looking to locate your local Center for Independent Living, which I think both Rob and I have mentioned as great grassroots local sources of information and assistance, there's a national directory on the ILRU at TIRR Memorial Herman website, and I apologize if I butchered how to pronounce that. If you go to their website, you can locate your closest Center for Independent Living and contact them. And then for much more detailed information on accommodating individuals with things like multiple chemical sensitivities, you certainly can contact the National Center for Environmental Health Strategies. And we've provided their phone number as well as email address for their executive director. And then finally, of course, the Department of Justice's ADA website at www.ada.gov. You can go to their website for a wealth of information, and you can even call using the 800 number to speak to an ADA specialist. And the Access Board, the United States Access Board's website, also has a wealth of information related to physical accessibility requirements. So those are some of the resources. I would like to remind everybody, please do take a moment and visit the National ADA Network's website at adata.org, where you can view and download the entire publication, a planning guide for making temporary events accessible to people with disabilities. And we hope that you find that guide of use when you are planning for your next temporary event. I think with that, I'm going to pass it back to Peter.
All right. Thank you very much, Jennifer, and thank you very much, Rob. What a great deal of information, very detailed, very relevant, and excellent information. So thank you both very much for presenting that. For those of you, again, just a quick reminder, if you're in the webinar room, you can submit your questions in the chat area. Click on it with the mouse, or you can control M, we'll put focus in there, and you can submit your question. At this time, Shanice, would you please give our telephone participants instructions on how they can ask questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have a question, please press the star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
And Jennifer and Rob, while we wait for that, and I will ask you the first question that we got into the webinar room, and they want to know, can we use the new accessibility symbol on signage?
Rob, do you want me to handle that one?
Sure, go ahead, Jennifer.
I'm not sure. The person asking the question, I'm not sure where they're from, but I do know that in New York State, for instance, they have a new accessible icon. It's called the Active Symbol for Accessibility. To be honest with you, the ADA does have a clause known as Equivalent Facilitation, which permits departures because the International Symbol for Accessibility in the 2010 ADA standards does not look exactly like the New York State accessible icon. And there may be other jurisdictions in the country that have one as well. So in terms of equivalent facilitation, I know that certain members of the Department of Justice's staff has said that they feel that it is equivalent facilitation, but I do not work for the Department of Justice, and I haven't seen any fact sheet printed, I should say, on that topic. So I would say that's probably one of those areas where I might recommend that you do indeed contact the Department of Justice's ADA hotline and ask one of their technical assistance specialists. But again, there is equivalent facilitation, which does permit departing from the exact technical specifications in the 2010 ADA standards.
Peter, I think you sent something out on that recently, haven't you?
When I saw the question coming in, what you guys were presenting, I was doing some research online, and I think this topic came up at the ADA symposium in Atlanta earlier this year during a town hall discussion. So I would like to do a little more research because I found something that quoted Sally Conway from the Justice Department and Rex Pace from the Access Board, but I do not want to pass it along before confirming what they are quoted as saying is accurate. So what I would say is that we will research that further and get that information out to all of you that have participated today. The question that came in wanted to know if the PowerPoint presentation would be made available, and also the comment that the presentation was excellent. So that's kudos to you, Jennifer, and to you, Rob. Yes, once the ADA audio website is back up and running, when we archive the session, the PowerPoint presentation along with handouts will be available for you. And I want to check, we don't have a lot of time left, but Shanice, do we have any questions from our telephone participants at this time?
We have one question from Rick Edwards. Your line is now open.
All right. Hello, Rick. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Peter. Thanks. I was in the room with Sally when she made that comment. She said that it did not meet equivalent facilitation because it wasn't equal or greater access. But I'll let you search that out with Sally. I had a quick question on the, I think it was on slide 22. I noticed that some of the text was behind the pictures. If I was going to see if that could be corrected or when the presentation is sent out.
This is Jennifer. I apologize. I think in possibly in formatting the presentation, I apologize. I noticed that as well, so I apologize for that.
Great. You did a great job. I appreciated that. I would also would like to, if I could, suggest that we take a look at when people put carpeting down in temporary facilities, make sure the edges are tacked down well, because that's one of those things that get curled up, especially on mats on grass and things like that.
So, very good point.
But thank you very much. Appreciated it.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the question, Rick. One comment that I just wanted to add in, and this is just related to my personal experience of working and volunteering with a temporary event in the community where I reside, and that's the issue of training. Many of these temporary events incorporate the use of many volunteers, and the event that I participated in attended arrived at the location. The accessible parking was beautiful, it was perfect. I was being accompanied by the ADA coordinator for the municipality. They had used workhorses to block off the access aisles. They had provided an access aisle for each individual parking space. They weren't even sharing access aisles. It was great. So we attended the event. We had volunteered doing something inside, and 8 hours later when we left, there were vehicles parked in every single access aisle. And we went up to the two young ladies that were working the parking at that time, and they said, well, so-and-so out there said we could let cars park in the access aisle. And there was a perfect example. The planning was great. They had set it up. They had put these workhorses. And then the execution of this plan, failed miserably because the folks on the front line, the higher-ups knew what their obligations were and what they needed to do. But there was a lack of communication to those volunteers on the front line. In executing the plan. So training is also always a key component to planning temporary events. Rob, I think this one is for you, and this question is, if portable toilets are used for a temporary event, how many of them are required to be accessible?
5%, but at least one.
All right. Excellent. Very good. This is, I guess, for either of you. The questioner wants to know if a church is putting on a summer festival, are they required to comply with these ADA requirements?
Want me to handle that one, Rob?
Yeah, go ahead.
The ADA generally does not apply to religious organizations like churches or synagogues. However, you, in terms of inclusion, you certainly would hope that even if the ADA does not apply to your specific event, that you are thinking about access. And it's very likely that, depending on the event, there could be local or state building codes that could impact accessibility, because unlike the ADA, local building codes consider, you know, churches and synagogues a place of assembly. So there are still going to be access requirements locally. There may also be other types of rules or regulations in place that could impact access, but generally the ADA does not apply to religious organizations.
Excellent. Another question here that someone had submitted in advance. Do the ADA standards apply to those temporary amusement rides that you see at summer and fall events in local communities?
I'll take that one. No, they don't. I think they must have had a good lobby, and they talked to the access board, and carnivals, those type of temporary events, the actual ride itself does not have to be under the 2010 ADA standards. Program access to goods and service, what do you think, Jennifer?
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, my gut reaction was the traveling or portable amusement rides and carnivals, those specifically are listed as an exception for the amusement ride portion. I would still think the presence of accessible routes and other features throughout the facility would be required, though. Toilet rooms, anything else we discussed.
Excellent. Well, we have reached the bottom of the hour, so if we were not able to get to your question, I would encourage you to please contact your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232 or by visiting the ADA National Network website, adata.org. I again want to thank on behalf of the network and personally the effort and work that Jennifer and Rob put into getting this presentation together. It was a whole lot of information and a whole lot of material that the two of them took on and did just an incredible time presenting. So thank you for your time this afternoon presenting, but more importantly, thank you for the time that you two spent in putting together today's presentation. As a reminder, the audio archive of today's session along with the materials, we hope, we have our fingers crossed, that we will have that available on the ada-audio.org website within 24 hours. The edited transcript we will have posted to that website within 7 business days. I hope that you all enjoyed the information that was provided to you today, and I hope that you will join us in September for our next session, which is scheduled for September the 15th. These ADA audio conference sessions are a success because of you attending and participating in them. This is an interesting session. I don't think it's one that we have addressed previously, and the topic of the session is, or the session title is, reporting clearly and accurately about disability. And so this will look at the media portrayal of persons with disabilities. You can get more information about that upcoming session and register by visiting the ada-audio.org website. You can give us a call at 877-232-1990 if you have questions about that. I also wanted to mention just really quickly, I gave a very brief introduction to Jennifer and Rob at the top of the session. You can view their full bio on the ada-audio.org website if you want to get more information about them. Again, thanks to all of you for joining us today. apologize again for the technical difficulties we encountered. And once again, thank you to Jennifer and Rob for your presentation today. For those of you in the webinar room, you can simply close out your browser to exit the webinar platform. For those of you on the telephone, you just simply need to hang up your telephone. Thanks, everyone, and good day.